This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. As a screenwriter, Ernest Cline was frustrated watching the plot lines he wrote get rewritten, edited, and sometimes destroyed in the process of making a movie. So when he penned his debut novel, Ready Player One, he was just trying to write a story that was entirely within his control. And then the book he set out to write for himself became a huge hit and is now being made into a motion picture directed by Steven Spielberg. So Ernest Cline felt quite a bit of pressure to write that second novel. That had to be at least as good, he thought. And his latest, Armada, is another sci-fi thriller, and it is receiving accolades from the literary and tech communities. Ernest Cline's going to be in North Carolina for events in Chapel Hill and Asheville next week. But first, he's with me on the State of Things. Welcome, Ernest.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about this Ready Player One. I mean, how much was that just to sort of satisfy your need to write the book you wanted? And what kind of aspirations did you have for it as a book that would sell?
Well, I had grown up reading science fiction and always wanted to try my hand at a novel. But my passion for many years had been screenwriting. And then when my first film, Fanboys, got made, the process, like you said, took about 10 years, and it ended up being really, really frustrating. So that made me want to pursue my longtime dream of trying to write fiction and see what would happen if I told a story with nobody micromanaging me and without having to worry about budgets or casting or any of the problems that go with getting a film produced. I just wanted to see what would happen if I could geek out directly with the reader. And when I finished the book, I wasn't sure if I could even get it published. You know, I was really just trying to write a novel to see if I could do it and see what would happen. And my whole life changed once the book went on the market. There was a bidding war for it in the New York publishing community, and that set off a bidding war in Hollywood with the rights going to Warner Brothers. So that was the moment that my whole life changed, and I became a full-time writer. But I never expected or anticipated any of that, and everything that's kind of happened since then has continued to shock me. The book has been published in over 40 other countries and translated into 30 some different languages, which blows me away.
Well, it's also required reading for some companies, right?
That's what I've been told. It's by Palmer Luckey at Oculus Rift, the virtual reality company. He read the book when he was first starting his Kickstarter campaign for the Oculus Rift, and he was so taken with it and thought it was so inspiring and showed the potential of virtual reality so much that he did make it required reading for everybody who came aboard the company. They would give them a copy of it, and they had me come to the offices and do a couple book signings. And then just 2 days ago, I did a signing at Google, and they told me a similar thing that, during job interviews, they ask potential employees if they've read Ready Player One, which is astounding.
Why do you think that is? I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, and there may be other required reading for them as well, but why do you think this book in particular grabs people who run these corporations?
That's hard to quantify, but I think that it has to do with, I was a member of the first generation to have home video games and home computers. I grew up in the 70s and 80s and worked in the IT industry all through the 90s and the aughts. And so I kind of grew up with the internet and watched the internet, be born and evolve into what it's become today. It started out as something that people rarely used or only a few people knew about, to now something that we're all kind of tethered to every minute of the day. And I could see the way that the gaming industry was all kind of also kind of developing in tandem with the internet, and the two were merging. And by watching, online role-playing games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft, I could see how we were taking steps toward virtual reality, even though we had been promised that technology since the 80s, since William Gibson wrote Neuromancer or Neal Stephenson wrote Snow Crash. I'd always grown up imagining and waiting for virtual reality to come about, but the technology didn't catch up with the idea until right around the time that I was lucky enough to publish my book. And I feel that part of it is timing. I wrote a whole novel kind of imagining the potential of a global interconnected virtual world that allowed everybody around the world to communicate and collaborate all the time, right as that was coming about. So Palmer Luckey was just on All Things Considered a few weeks ago, and he said that it was a fun book and enjoyable to read, and it presented virtual reality in a way that anybody could understand and see its potential in education and communication and in the workplace. And so it's kind of a primer for that.
Well, let's talk about this with the success of that book, and now it's going to be made into a film. Now you've got your next book out, Armada, but you sit down to write this book. Did that put some pressure on you to come up with a great second book?
It was a great deal of pressure and something that I'd never, expected to have to deal with. My first novel. I didn't expect it to be a runaway success or there to be a movie deal or any of that. And the success of it just continued to grow, as I was beginning to write my second novel. But I was lucky enough to, have made during the promotion and book touring for Ready Player One, I was lucky enough to make friends with a lot of other writers who had faced the same thing. And they, communicated their sympathy to me and told me how they had dealt with it. One of them being George R. Martin. I'm actually doing a signing at George R. Martin's cinema in Santa Fe, New Mexico, just in a couple days now. And he and I became friends. I remember having breakfast with him, and he asked me how my second novel was going. And I said, oh, so much pressure. I don't even, with the movie deal and the first thing, and then I had forgotten who I was talking to, no one's under more
tell
pressure.
Tell us more about his work, just a little bit about his work for those of me who don't know him that well.
Well, he's the writer of The Song of Ice and Fire, which is the huge success of HBO, which I think is now the most popular television show around the world, Game of Thrones. And so he had written all those books, for years, one every couple of years. And it wasn't until the show became a runaway success that he had this global audience. And now he has, I think, more pressure on him than any writer. Now the television show has actually caught up with him with his book series and is getting ahead of him a little bit. But it's like a running joke. That George needs to write faster. People write songs about that. He went to the Emmy Awards and they brought a typewriter down and sat it in front of his chair and everybody was laughing except George, So no one is under any more pressure than he is. And other writer friends of mine like Patrick Rothfuss and Hugh Howey and even Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, have all faced, going forward with your sophomore effort. And it's something that I think all artists face, if like a rock band has a really successful first album and then they have to follow that up. But you evolve as an artist and you always want to try something new, but people now have expectations.
Right.
But what a lot of people have told me and what George expressed to me is it's a really good problem to have. It's high class problems. It's much better to have, thousands or even millions of people waiting for your next effort than to have nobody waiting or interested at all. So it was a lot of pressure, but also really exciting to me. When I sold the book rights for Armada, I had only kind of written a 7-page outline that I sold to Penguin Random House. And then that same week, I sold the film rights to Universal Pictures. So it was a complete opposite of Ready Player One. I knew that it was going to be a novel that was published and read by a lot of people, and that as soon as I finished the novel, that I would have to start working on the screenplay adaptation. Right. But again, like a dream come true, but also a lot of pressure.
Well, let's talk about Armada. The main character, Zach, is a gamer, and he watches his game become reality. So tell us what happened.
In the story, it's I was inspired by a lot of different things when I was growing up. I remember reading in a video game magazine about the 1982 game Battlezone that was released by Atari, which was bought by the U.S. Army, and they hired the original programmer to reprogram it into military training simulation called Bradley Trainer to train soldiers to operate the new Bradley fighting vehicle that had just come out. And that really was the germ of the idea that set my imagination afire, the idea that video games, the video games I'd grown up playing could actually teach you to do things in the real world and that they were at their heart simulations. And I was also a huge fan of the novel Ender's Game, which explored that idea as well, and the film The Last Starfighter, which is one of my movies. And growing up, one of my favorite movies. And growing up as a child of Star Wars, I spent a lot of time imagining what if, all the pop culture that Star Wars spawned and everything that had happened since then and all the alien invasion movies I've kind of spent my whole life growing up and watching, like Independence Day and War of the Worlds, what if those were all to psychologically condition us to prepare for an alien a coming alien invasion? And what if the video games that we had all spent decades, mastering were secretly used to train us to operate drones to fight off a coming an alien invasion? And that was the heart of the story. My brother is a major in the United States Marine Corps, and he explosive ordnance disposal technician, and they use drones to disarm bombs, and the video and the controllers that they use just like look like Xbox and PlayStation controllers. And I found out that they do that to lower the learning curve for soldiers who have spent their whole lives playing video games. Mm-hmm. They immediately pick up these controllers and operate drones. So that was a really fun idea, and that's what happens to Zach in the story. He discovers that his whole life, kind of absorbing all the science fiction was to help, prepare him psychologically for an alien invasion, and that the whole video game industry all around the world was kind of subterfuge to train the people of Earth and prepare them to operate an army of drones to fight off an alien invasion. It was a lot of fun and kind of very much in my wheelhouse, and I was able to write about all the different elements of video games and technology that I grew up
loving. Well, you know,
Ernie,
I have to tell you that there's enough scary going on in this state so that you don't need to make me more paranoid, but you did. listen, I want to play a clip now of an actor who's reading from the audiobook Armada, and in this scene, and you, I don't know if we need to set it up anymore, but in this scene, Zach is seeing the ship. A ship, and he's wondering if he's imagining something. Do we need to set this up anymore? Or can I?
Well, I'll tell you that the audiobook reader is one of my favorite actors, Will Wheaton, who played Wesley Crusher on Star Trek, and he was in Stand By Me, and he's on The Big Bang Theory now, and he's about the same age as me, so he is just he's the perfect. That's why I don't read my stories myself. He's a much better conduit, so I hope you enjoy this.
Here we go.
I was looking at a Sobrukai Glaive, one of the fighter ships piloted by the alien bad guys in Armada, my favorite video game. Which was, of course, impossible. Like seeing a TIE fighter or a Klingon warbird cruising across the sky. The Sobrukai and their Glaive fighters were fictional video game creations. They didn't exist in the real world. They couldn't. In reality, video games did not come to life, and fictional spaceships did not buzz your hometown. Implausible like that only happened in cheesy 80s movies like Tron or War Games or The Last Starfighter, the sorts of movies my late father had been nuts about. The gleaming craft banked sideways again, and this time I got an even better look. There was no doubt about it. I was looking at a glaive right down to the distinctive claw-like grooves along its fuselage and the twin plasma cannons protruding from the front end like two fangs. There was only one logical explanation for what I was seeing. I had to be hallucinating. And I knew what sort of people suffered from hallucinations in broad daylight without any help from drugs or alcohol. People who were cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, that's who.
That's a reading from Armada, the new book by Ernest Cline. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Tuesday and Malaprops in Asheville on Wednesday. So Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, a pop culture reference, one of many. You love using those. They're pretty cool throughout the book.
Thank you. Well, that for me, you know, there's no pop culture is kind of the only culture I've ever known. I was born in 1972 and grew up with pop culture as my culture. So for me, it's just another kind of one of the paints on my palette, another way for me to tell a story and connect with people. And if you know, when characters in a story or in a film refer to things from my life, it draws me further into the story and lets me know that those characters exist in the same world that I do. And I've since discovered that, you know, by touring in other countries like Norway and Italy and Finland, that American pop culture is so pervasive over there that they grew up with all the same stuff. And these references resonate with people all around the world. So that's been a shock to me.
Several of the technological developments that you have dreamed up as fiction have now become reality. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of science fiction. See how much of this actually happens. And I wonder for you, how much of this is you actually imagining this stuff happening, and to what extent it just helps develop the plot? I don't care if it ever happens. I mean, do you sort of imagine and or hope that some of this stuff is actually going to happen?
Well, I do a bit. Like, virtual reality was something that I had always dreamed of, you know, like from way back in the 80s when I read Neuromancer, which, you know, William Gibson wrote on a typewriter before the internet even existed. And then the other book I mentioned, Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, also kind of imagined the internet, but evolving into a global virtual reality. And so that was something that I always hoped for and looked forward to. And in the book, I imagined it taking much longer than it actually does. You know, the Oculus Rift just started shipping last month, and it's backordered, you know, through the summer because they can't make them fast enough. The Vive virtual reality headset has also started to ship. So I actually I have an Oculus Rift connected to my computer. I have virtual reality at home now, which is not the case when I was writing this book just 4 or 5 years ago. That's how fast the future is catching up. So it makes me – it's really flattering. It makes me feel like Arthur C. Clarke, you know, a little bit like predicting the satellite before in his fiction before it actually happened.
Armada also includes a romantic subplot. Tell us about your decision to include that.
Well, that's romance is such a part of life. And there's also a family story, and it's at its heart a father-son story, but there is a romance. And, you know, that always draws me more into a story. And all my favorite kind of coming-of-age stories involve some element of romance and meeting someone. And that's part of Ready Player One and both Armada, you know, both of the books. Meeting someone and having a connection, and having that connection sometimes happen through a mutual shared interest in film or video games or something that you're passionate about. That's one of the most exciting things that's ever happened to me in my own life. And so that's something I always want to – and I think the one of the most exciting things that happens to almost everyone, you know, falling in love. So that's always something fun to include in my stories.
Both of these books are becoming movies. And you talked about your frustrations as a screenwriter writing screenplays and then watching them get butchered. What happens in the process of making your books into a movie? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm so lucky because I was already established as a screenwriter and a member of the Writers Guild when I sold both my novels. It was part of the film option contract that I had to be allowed to write the first few drafts of the screenplay, which allowed me to kind of influence the direction that the film adaptations would take. So I wrote the first few drafts of the Ready Player One screenplay, and I'm lucky enough to be close friends with Zach Penn, the writer who's working on the rewrites of the shooting draft of the script right now, and he's kept me really involved in the process. And has also kind of kept me abreast of what's happening with Steven Spielberg's input on the project. He called me up after Steven Spielberg's first meeting with Warner Brothers and told me that he came in with a copy of my book that had 53 Post-it notes in it.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you here for a minute because, okay, you're writing a book and you've got some sort of authorial kind of commitment to the book. Can you really walk in and say, hey, Spielberg, forget it. You got it all wrong. Look, here's how it was written. Stick with it. You can't do
no,
that.
No, I could not. Well, he helped inspire the story. The protagonist of Ready Player One carries a Grail diary because of Indiana Jones throughout the story. So he had such a huge influence on me. I'm so, you know, I just, it's a dream come true to have him, to get to work with him.
All right. So you did you mentioned your first book tour a few minutes ago. You did that in a DeLorean, right?
It's true. It makes me a lot more interesting at my book signings when I show up in a time machine. And I also used it in my author photo, which makes it a business expense, not just a giant toy that I've wanted to own since I was a young man. So I still bring it to my book signings. It's like a traveling 80s museum. So it's so much fun. And it's a way for me to bring part of the book to life.
Kind of a mixed bag technologically, because on the one hand, it is the emblem of time travel. On the other hand, the emblem of failed technology. I mean, don't you think?
It's true. Well, a little bit. They're actually bringing the DeLorean back. I heard just they announced last year they're going to start remaking them. Stylistically, it's still one of the one of the best looking cars ever.
I understand you have a problem, though, driving this thing around. You've run into some problems on the road when you drive a DeLorean. Is that right?
Exciting on one at one level because people are always giving you thumbs up. And I've had, like, stoplights. I've had people, like, bow to the car because everybody has such fond memories of it. But police officers pull me over all the time. Uh-huh. And never give me a ticket. The first time I got pulled over, the police officer kind of kept me at the side of the road for 15 minutes and wouldn't let me leave until three other cop cars showed up. And he had called his friends all to come over to take pictures at the side of the road with the car. So it's like something that everybody gets a kick out of.
All right. Ernie, next book in the works? Is your
yes. I'm right in the midst of finishing the screenplay adaptation of Armada for Universal Pictures. And as soon as I finish that, then I'm going to start on my third novel, which is the story still top secret. But thank you for asking.
All right. Well, come back then. Ernest Cline, the author of Armada, as well as Ready Player One. He speaks at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Tuesday and Malaprops in Asheville on Wednesday. We've got those details at our website, stateofthinks.org. Thanks, Ernie.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, music of the Great Animal Orchestra Symphony. Stay tuned.